If you're a fan of big ideas, debate, and politics, check out our festival partner, geopolitical magazine, Foreign Policy. A forum for informed debate about global affairs, Foreign Policy keeps a finger on the pulse of world news and political happenings. Beyond articles that delve behind the headlines via traditional reporting, Foreign Policy has so many other products to offer, ensuring that no matter how you like to engage with eye-opening content, there is a method for you. Check out their free offerings, like Foreign Policy Live, their forum for live journalism, newsletters, and podcasts. And with a subscription, unlock in-depth features and quarterly magazines, including their recently dropped spring edition, All About India. Fans of IAI will love Foreign Policy for more of the mind-expanding, insightful content that they seek. To explore their content, take advantage of an exclusive discount for IAI fans. Subscribe now using promo code LIGHT24 to save 50% and unlock access to everything Foreign Policy has to offer.
Hello, hello. My name is Dan Ariely, and I'm the James B. Duke Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics at Duke University. And I come to you live today from Israel, a very complex, painful place these days. And what I want to talk today about is my recent book called Misbelief. And actually, I want to talk more about the adventures that led to it and what I learned. Okay, so here's the story. Think back to the beginning of COVID. I don't know how you felt at the time, but I felt I was at the height of my academic career. Why? Because I felt I was very useful. Yes, the problem was, you know, with COVID, but lots of social science problems appeared as well. What do we do with distant education? And what do we do with distant work? And what do we do with furlough and unemployment? There was a rise in domestic violence. There were a ton of questions that were very important, very urgent, and had to do very basically with social science. And I tried to be as helpful as possible. So here I was working day and night on nothing else but things related to social science and this epidemic. And at some point in July, I get an email from somebody I once knew and I actually helped once. And this email says, Dan, what happened to you? How have you changed? How have you become that person? And I write back and I say, how have I changed? And I get back a long email with a long list of URLs, each of them proving how much I have changed. So I'll not tell you about all of them. I'll tell you about one of those links. In one of those links, there was a video of me when I was injured. By the way, this strange looking half a beard, there's a whole story behind it, but very simply, most of my body, including the right side of my face, was burnt. So all of this is scars. I just don't have hair. Also, my hands look strange and I have scars all over my body. Anyway, that video shows pictures of me in hospital, very brutal pictures. It says that I was in hospital for about 3 years, true. Burned in about 70% of my body, true. But then it goes to say that because of that injury, I started hating healthy people, not true. And that's why I joined the cabal, Bill Gates and the Illuminati, to try and kill as many healthy people as possible. And that's what the plandemic is about. These were the days before the vaccine was around, but it also predicted that the vaccine is another tool by the Illuminati to kill as many people as possible. Anyway, there were many videos and maybe stories, and people had all kinds of opinions about me. And I looked at those videos and I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe they were accusing me. I thought I was waking up every day just trying to do good. And here I was accused in this way. So my first instinct was to call these people up and say, hey, you're wrong. You know, you have this impression on me. You're just wrong. But then I thought better and I decided to call some experts from the PR world. And they all told me the same thing. They say, don't touch it, don't talk to them, don't participate, just don't. But as much as I was proud for asking them for their opinion, I couldn't take their advice. It was just too much, some of my inherent limitation. So I went ahead. I called some of them. I invited some of them to my house. I met some of them outdoors. I joined Zoom calls and I joined discussions. I joined Telegram groups. I did all kinds of things. And at the end of the month, I basically did nothing. I did nothing. I didn't manage to convince almost anybody that I was not the evil person that they thought I was. And this was very shocking because, you know, if you think about it, if you think about the last 5 years of our lives, we can all think about people that 5 years ago we felt that we understand the world in the same way. Here is me, here's this other person, we understand the world in the same way. And now, probably all have somebody in your close or less close circle that you say, how did I ever think that we are sharing a reality? That those people look to you and say, are we really looking at the same thing? How did we come up to some such different conclusions? Anyway, it's one thing to know about this. Yes, there are people who believe the earth is flat, all kinds of things. But it's an unbelievable experience to come to somebody and somebody says, you're evil. And I say, what did they do? And he said, you did this on Wednesday. And I said, no, I didn't. Here's my calendar. I didn't. I was in a different place altogether. And they say, no, no, you were there. There's something very eerie about that. Anyway, at the end of that month that I just wasted time, I realized that the issue of misbelief is very big. And it's something that I need to spend time on to understand. Now, over the years, I usually would do research and then I would try to write about my research. This one, I felt the problem was handed to me and I had to try and write a book to try and describe this complex system. One of the conclusions I got after 2 years of talking to many of those misbelievers, doing some academic research, reading a lot about what is going on, spending a lot of time in all kinds of dark corners of the internet, the first conclusion I came to is those people who are misbelievers, they should not be discounted, and we shouldn't discount their beliefs either. And I don't mean that they're correct, they're not correct, but those processes, those people and those beliefs fulfill an important need. Now, it's not the ideal way to fulfill this need, but it's a way to fulfill this need. Imagine somebody has a mosquito bite, they have a need to itch it. Is it a good thing to itch? No. But do they have a real need to itch? Absolutely, yes. And the same thing goes for this going down the funnel of misbelief, starting to develop alternative theories, getting more and more into that. All of that is answering a real need. So we shouldn't discount the people and we shouldn't discount their opinion, but we should try to understand what is going on. Where are they coming from? Why are they doing this? Okay, so I said there was this funnel of misbelief. There's a system that attacks almost all of our psychology. You know, in the same way that the cookie, you can think about the cookie as a weaponized food that attacks our receptors for sugar, fat, salt, in an ideal combination that gets us to want one and then to consume more. The funnel of misbelief attacks a lot of our psychology. It attacks our emotional system and stress. It attacks our cognitive system, our personality system, and our social system. And I don't think that anybody designed that for that, but it came about to have a system that basically takes people, normal, lovable, wonderful, intelligent, creative people, and pushes them down this funnel of misbelief. Okay, So what is the psychology of the funnel of misbelief? The first element is stress. And stress creates the conditions for people to want to find a story. People feel stress. And I don't mean the stress of saying, wow, I'm so busy, I don't know how I'll finish the day. I mean the stress of the type that says, I don't understand the world. I don't understand why I'm not doing better. I don't understand why I lost my job and other people didn't. I don't understand why I'm attacked. I don't understand why, you know, something is happening in China. I'm not understanding. I'm basically like feeling hard done by. My lot in life is not very good and I don't understand why. Now that setting creates a need for a story. And by the way, it's not just about conspiracy theories. Think about fishermen. Imagine fishermen who fish in the ocean versus fishermen who fish in a lake. Which one of them do you think have a more unpredictable life? Obviously the one in the ocean. Storms, currents, all kinds of things. Which one developed more superstitions? The one in the ocean. We basically are trying to feel that we control the world. And one way to do it is with superstition. Oh, I'll clap twice and something will happen. But another way is to have a story that organizes things. So when people feel stress, hard done by, they look for a story. But not all stories are made the same. What story do we want? We want a story with the villain and we want a complex story. Why a complex story? You usually think that people want simple stories. Why a complex story? Why the cabal and this and all kinds of things like that? Why a complex story? By the way, one of the most complex stories, of course, is the Earth is flat. Just think how many people need to be involved. NASA, every government, every space program, every pilot, they all know it. They don't share anything. It's a very complex conspiracy. So why complex? Because if people feel hard done by, they feel that society is looking down at them, having a complex story can tell, let them feel that I know something society doesn't understand. Oh, you think that this is a virus that started in China, randomly, random mutation. No, no, no. Let me tell you what's really happening. It's this and this and this. So stress creates a need for a story, and the story is better if it's with a villain and a complex story. So that's part one. The second part is the cognitive system. And we all know lots of things about the cognitive system. We all choose to see the television or read the newspaper that will give us the information we believe in already. Confirmation bias. We can also bend reality. We can ignore facts we don't like. But there's another element there called the illusion of explanatory depth. I'll tell you how it works. So in one experiment we did, we asked people about the flush toilet, you know, one of those things. Do you understand how a flush toilet works? Yes. On a scale from 0 to 10, great, wonderful. Luckily for you, we have all the pieces of a flush toilet here. Take them and try and assemble them. People try, nobody in our experiment managed to assemble it. And then we say, what do you think now? How much do you understand flush toilet? People say, not so much. Now, what's the idea here? The idea is that usually when we argue with somebody, we fight. You don't agree with me? Here's another piece of information. Here's another data point. You don't agree? Here's another one. We fight. How successful are we in that approach? Think to yourself, in the last year, how many people have you convinced deeply that they were wrong about something? How many times in the last year were you convinced that you were wrong about something? The reality is that when somebody argues with us, we argue back. In our mind, before we say something, even before they finish the first sentence, they start saying something, we start thinking about why they're wrong. We say something, they start thinking about why it's wrong. And the reality is that at the end of this debate, we're each more sure about our original point because we did not spend the time listening. We spend the time counter-arguing. And by the way, it's our arguments. We believe them and so on. So the illusion of explanatory depth, and by the way, this is a good trick to try and help people change their opinion. doesn't attack people. You come from their perspective. You say, oh, you think you understand the flush toilet? Help me understand. How do you build it? Oh, you think you understand how a zipper works? Help me understand. How does it work? Oh, you think that the elections in the US were stolen? Help me understand. How do elections get tallied in general, and where was it stolen from? Basically, in many, many things, we have a lot of confidence in our opinions, but the reality is that we don't really know that much. And the approach using the illusion of explanatory depth uses that, not by arguing with people, but saying to people, I fully trust you. Just help me understand this. Give me a bit more details. Help me understand how this would work. Okay, so we said stress is the foundation. Without stress, people don't go down the funnel of misbelief. And there's all kinds of elements in the cognitive system that take us down this funnel of misbelief. The next thing is personality. The people who are more likely to go down the funnel of misbelief and people who are less likely. By the way, just because you have the personality trait of somebody who would go down more easily down the funnel of misbelief, doesn't mean that it's deterministic. Doesn't mean you will certainly go. And if you don't have those personality traits, it doesn't mean you will not go. It just lubricates the path, right? But with enough stress, everybody would go. Just with moderate stress, some people are more likely and less likely. So what are those personality traits? There's all kinds of them. One of them is to make connections between things that don't have connection. Basically, a very creative type. Oh, look at this point, at this point. Dan once worked with the Gates Foundation. He worked on vaccines. Yep, we finished solving the problem. So creativity, very good trait, wonderful to have, also increases the risk of going down the funnel of misbelief. Another one, and I'll give you an example. Think about the following simple math problem. A baseball bat and a baseball ball cost together $1.10. A baseball bat and a baseball ball cost together $1.10. The bat cost $1 more than the ball. The bat cost $1 more than the ball. And the question is, how much does the ball cost? And when you ask people this question, most people want to say 10 cents. That's the thing that comes most naturally. Together $1.10, the difference is $1. 10 cents kind of comes to mind. And some people just say it. 10 cents. I thought about 10 cents. I say 10 cents. And some people think about it for another minute. They said, well, if it was 10 cents, if the ball was 10 cents and the bat was $1 more, the bat would be $1.10. And then together, they will be $1.20. 10 cents and $1.10 together, it's $1.20. But Dan said that together they need to be $1.10. So maybe it's 5 cents and $1.05. Yeah, that works. Difference is $1. The sum is $1.10. Not complex math. Everybody can do it, but some people trust their intuition and don't bother with the testing, and some people test themselves. And it turns out that among the misbelievers, there are many more people who trust their intuition. And you can see how. You basically see something, it's an explanation. Rather than go deeply into it and ask yourself, is this correct or not? You say, seems right. My intuition tells me it's right. Let me trust it. You go down more easily down the funnel of misbelief. Stress, cognition, personality, there are more in each of those. They're quite interesting. And the last element is the social element. And I don't just mean social media, but of course, social media plays quite a large role in this. So even in the social parts, there are a few elements. The first one is ostracism. And ostracism is basically the feeling of being rejected from society. So imagine an experiment. There are two people who work for the experimenter and one participant. The participant doesn't know that these two people are working for the experimenter, and they meet outside the experimenter booth. It's outside, and one of the research assistants picks a soccer ball and start tossing it between the three people. They play with it for 10 minutes, and then the participant goes in the room and does the testing. That's condition one. The second condition, everything does the same way. They pick the ball, they play for 5 minutes this time, and then they stop throwing it, they stop tossing it to the real participant, and they just play it among themselves. So in the second condition, in the ostracized condition, a person felt like they were part of the group, but then the group rejected them. They just feel for 5 minutes, nobody tossed the ball to them. What's the difference? Well, it turns out the differences are very substantial. When you test those people, they're less optimistic about life, they're less helpful, they cheat more, they cooperate less, all kinds of bad things happen. Basically, I think that everything bad, everything good about humanity gets to be there at a lower degree. And the reality is that ostracism is very powerful. When I started thinking about things this way, I realized that I used to use the expression, what color is the sky in your world? When somebody would come to me with some strange theory, I would use that expression. And when I used that expression, I thought I was slightly funny. But in retrospect, I think, yeah, maybe I was slightly funny, but they were much more offended than I was funny. Because the person who is saying, what color is the sky in your world, is think of it as a little offense, as a little funny, but the person receiving that, that's a rejection. That's a rejection. And rejection is much more powerful than we think. So with society, people start developing some strange ideas. They have pressure. They want to find story, a villain, a complex story. They propose it to other people. Other people ridicule them even a little bit. They feel ridiculed a lot. And now what do? They try to find people like them. Yeah, they try to find people who would agree with them. We would all do the same thing. And thankfully, or not so thankfully, but they, in the internet, they can find people who believe in almost anything. So they join a group, and that group believes in X, whatever it is. Now, imagine that you join one of those groups. You want to be seen above the fold. You want to be one of the people that get likes, and you want to feel that you're contributing and that you're a member of that team. What would you do? What would you do? It turns out that you have to say extreme things. Now, there's a story from the Bible about something called Shibboleth. And here's the story. There are two tribes, and they have a war. And after the war, they settle on two sides of the river. But then they walk around, and they don't know if the people that they meet are from their tribe or from the other tribe. Well, these two tribes pronounced the name of the plant, Shibboleth, in a different way. One of them said Shibboleth, and one of them said Sibboleth. So imagine we're after this war, and I walk around, and I meet you, and I say, how do you call this plant? And if you say it the way I say it, we hug and everything is good. And if you say it the way that the other tribe is saying it, I chase you away or try to pick a fight with you. Now, the thing about this is when I show you this plant, do I care about the plant? No. What am I really asking? I'm asking you for identity. I'm asking you for identity. And that's actually how we use this term, Shibboleth, these days. The way we use it is to say that there are some discussions that are not about the facts. They might look like they're about the facts, but they're not about the facts. But those discussions are about the establishment of loyalty. They're about the establishment of identity. I belong to this group. Look how much I am to the right. I am saying that, whatever. Look how much I am to the left. I'm saying that, whatever. By the way, people think, oh, it's the other side of the political spectrum that have all of these crazy opinions, not us. Not true. All of us are susceptible. All of us are susceptible to it, both sides of the spectrum. So Shibboleth is the next thing. So we get ostracized, we join a group, then we need to portray ourselves, we say more extreme things, we get more liked, and things move on. And then there's the last part of the social element, which is cognitive dissonance. Now, we all know cognitive dissonance, and we all remember the stories, but The basic idea of cognitive dissonance is that beliefs follow actions. Usually we think we have beliefs and our actions reflect our beliefs. What cognitive dissonance shows is that if we act in a certain way and we invest a lot of energy in that way, we can't say we were wrong. The investment of the energy by itself forces our opinions to follow. So think about somebody that invested lots of effort in whatever theory. And they think the US election was stolen, they think that the world is flat, whatever it is. They feel that vaccines are dangerous, they feel it doesn't matter what it is. But think about somebody who spent a substantial amount of their time on these topics. Is it possible for those people to say, you know what, I was wrong? It's possible, but it's very, very hard. What's much more likely? What's much more likely is that people would find a way to increase their commitment. You know, in the original Festinger study, these believers in this woman who said that the world would get destroyed and aliens would come and they would only save her and her followers. The people who are diehard believers, the people who were the most disappointed that the world didn't destroy and no aliens came and so on, they could not admit that they were wrong and they became even stronger followers. Whereas the people who were kind of on the fence said, okay, you know, we thought maybe she's the prophet, maybe she's not, we'll go home. Once we act in a certain direction, we can't really go back. It's very hard, which is why even people who started the journey on misbelief in politics A or politics B or COVID or whatever, basically can't go back. They just go to another theory in another group in another activity. Okay, so that's the story of the funnel of this funnel of misbelief. But the whole thing is actually wrapped in an important wrapper, which is trust. You know, there's this story that fish don't know that they're in water because they're surrounded by fish. In the same way, in society, we're surrounded by trust to such a degree that we don't see how trust is necessarily working. It's all around us. We trust that the elevator would work, and we trust that traffic lights would work and electricity would work and our, you know, you name it, that our credit card would be accepted and our bank will not take our money away. And just so much trust. Amazing. It would be very hard without it. But one of the things that misbelief does is to basically chip at people's trust. You know, if we take the people who believe the earth is flat, it's not that it's just to believe the earth is flat. Misbelief is about a wrong belief in the world, but it's about taking that as a central perspective in people's mind. And that central perspective is a perspective from which they view everything else. Somebody who believes the earth is flat is saying, NASA is lying to us. The government is lying to us. Every school system is lying to us. Every pilot knows the truth and they're lying to us. This is not just about you say, oh, you know, I'm not so sure. I never saw real evidence. I don't understand exactly the calculation. I'm not so sure. No. People who are truly misbelievers are viewing the world with suspicion. I had one night when I talked to one of the misbelievers and I realized how difficult it is to be a misbeliever. You know, nobody would pick this. Nobody would want to think that there are G5 chips in vaccines and that somebody is trying to poison them and their kids and to get them to be infertile. It's a terrible life. It's a terrible life. People don't pick it. It's kind of a sad side effect of all kinds of other things. But the reality is it's not good. And it's not good in the fact that it's a perspective on life that just gets worse and worse and worse. Okay, last word. When I started writing this book, Misbelief, I thought I'll have a chapter on solutions. Ended up not having a chapter on solution. I have all kinds of little sections called Hopefully Helpful that help us in our personal lives and help us with our friends and have discussions and so on. The reality is that misbelief is a big problem, much bigger than I thought when I started. And it's at the base for lots of other things. You know, we can't really make progress on almost anything else that we are tackling, from wars to global warming, unless we get the foundation of belief in the world. So while I don't have a chapter on solution, I have some ideas, but mostly I think we need to think of this as one of the major problems that we need to try and tackle and try and solve.